Hello, and welcome to today's City Club of Boise program, a virtual conversation probing the question, why has the promise of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 not been realized? I'm Mike Satz, City Club board member and today's moderator. This program is being delivered online, so welcome attendees. Please note that the video or audio will not be available from your computers. We'll only be seeing and hearing from our panelists. We are recording this program, and I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout Southern Idaho and Northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take the time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens in a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climate Tech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mine Development. City Club of Boise receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thanks also to our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, Idaho Statesman, and Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, University of Idaho and Boise State University and Northwest Nazarene University. Many thanks to those of you who support City Club of Boise with membership or a donation during registrations. First, I would like to introduce Dr. Sydney Freeman, who is an associate professor of adult organizational learning and leadership at the University of Idaho. He is a former National Holmes Scholar and has earned professional certifications in the areas of faculty development, online instruction, executive management, and organizational leadership. His research investigates the future of minority-serving institutions, the faculty career cycle, and higher education as a field of study. Next, I would like to introduce Shakira R. Sanders. Professor Sanders became the first African-American and second person of color to achieve the rank of full professor at the University of Idaho College of Law in 2018. Professor Sanders teaches courses related to U.S. constitutional law and criminal procedure. She previously coached or co-coached the national moot court competition teams in Boise and Moscow. She serves as faculty advisor for the American Constitution Society and the ACLU Student Law Group. She previously served as faculty advisor for the Idaho Critical Legal Studies Journal and the Public Interest Law Group. And finally, Ty Simpson. Ty is the storyteller in the indigenous language of the Nimiipuu Nation, the Nez Perce tribe of Idaho. She lives and works in the Boise, Idaho area. Her insight into politics and social justice work are invaluable in schools, business events, and community leadership. She is a direct descendant of Chief Red Heart of the Nez Perce tribe and a tireless advocate for social justice. Ty's academic background is in political philosophy and public law at Boise State University, where she served as the vice president and president of the Intertribal Native Council Student Organization. In the community, she serves as an organizer and social change advocate and helped organize the June 6, 2020 Black Lives Matter rally in Boise, Idaho. And a note from myself, that rally was probably the largest rally I have seen in my 16 years here in Idaho. So congratulations to you on that, Ty. So without any further ado, we'll go ahead and get started with some questions for the panel that I have. First off, I would like to ask Professor Sanders, if you don't mind, if you could give a brief description of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and what it was intended to address.
Right. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964, just a little bit of a factoid, was not the first Civil Rights Act that Congress passed. Now, I'll talk a little bit about that previous act, but our 64 Act, the purpose was to address public and private race and gender discrimination. So if you think about the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the court had ruled when it struck down the original Civil Rights Act of 1875 that the Equal Protection Clause did not stop private discrimination. It only concerned public discrimination. Of course, that did not stop the next several years of state-sanctioned Jim Crow laws, and I should say next several decades of state-sanctioned Jim Crow law, which is what led us to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what did this law do? Well, one, it banned segregation in places of public accommodation. In this respect, the 1964 Civil Rights Act legislatively overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. If you remember, Brown versus Board of Education had already overturned Plessy, but only with regards to public education. It was the 1964 Act that said no more segregation in places of public accommodation. The law also banned discrimination based on race, color, religion, and sex in employment and in education. And if we'll remember, quite recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has told us that sex includes sexual orientation and gender identity. So we can kind of see how the 1964 Act is still evolving there. This act created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or expanded the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, which ultimately advocated for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it banned unequal voter registration requirements, which was a huge thing at the time. So you should know that this act exempted Native American tribes, religious groups, and private nonprofit member organizations. Finally, and this is sort of an unsolved mystery that's left over from the 1964 Act, it was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court under the Commerce Clause. But Congress also used its power under the 14th Amendment when it passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So there's still a lot of debate out there about the legitimacy of the use of the Commerce Clause to combat race and gender discrimination specifically. And there's still the open question of the scope and power of the 14th Amendment to combat race discrimination in this way, because we still never gotten a ruling from the Supreme Court on whether this is constitutional under the Equal Protection Clause.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Sanders. And I'm just going to note, Professor Sanders was previously one of my colleagues. And as you can see, the University of Idaho College of Law has a fabulous professor right there. And you can see how excited she gets when she's teaching. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, we certainly miss you very much on the faculty, Mike.
I'm still around hanging out. So, right. For maybe Professor Freeman, you can start, but this is really for all of our panelists. So as really accomplished professionals, what does the Civil Rights Act personally mean to you, and does it have an impact on you personally or professionally?
Well, I first want to say thank you so much to Mike for inviting me to be a part of this distinguished panel. And I had to do a little research to kind of get myself up to date on the Civil Rights Act. But what it means to me is that it was an attempt to level the playing field for all of us that are here in these United States. But I should say the yet to be United States, as some would say. One of the things that I think is really important, and I want to thank Ty, I believe that's her name, Ty, for her work with the Black Lives Matter movement, is that we now are able to have really frank conversations about the ways in which our society has not gotten to where Martin Luther King has said we would like to go to become a beloved community. And so some of the areas in which we have not created the appropriate parity across the board are areas like housing, areas like education, other things like gentrification, where that's a big word for essentially just moving in particular, communities of color out of particular areas and pushing them out into other areas. And then white people and those of means are able to move into those same areas. Issues related to access to proper nutrition, what we call food deserts. There are plenty of communities where poor minoritized communities don't have equal access to high quality food. These are some of the things that come to mind when thinking about providing the appropriate access to having a better life. And so we see job discrimination, we see over-policing and minoritized communities. And when I say minoritized, I'm talking about communities that are underserved in many respects. So I am glad that the Black Lives Matter movement has pushed some of these things to the forefront. I am sad because of the way in which it's had to be highlighted by the death of George Floyd and others. But I appreciate that we have people that are on the front lines pushing towards us becoming that beloved community, one in which we are treated equitably, and not equally, but equitably, so that we can move forward. Thank you.
All right. Right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Freeman. And you mentioned George Floyd, and it's sort of a personal mission of mine also to always mention Breonna Taylor at the same time, who was a woman who was killed by police in her bed. And I think that it's important we don't forget her either. Ty, how about yourself from your perspective?
Yeah, Amakis Katsiayo, thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this panel. Like, part of me is low-key fangirling over here because all of you are just professionals in the community that I aspired like to be there eventually. So thank you.
You're there. You're there, Ty. You're
doing I just haven't done job. The law school thing yet, but Shakir and I can talk about that later. I do want to identify something really quick. So the vigil that was planned that we had put together in June was unassociated with the official Black Lives Matter movement. So that's an important distinguisher to make. I'm also not associated with the official BLM chapter on a national level, but I am a Black woman. I am a Black life. I do this work for justice and equity and truth, and that's all very important and near and dear to my heart. And also why the Civil Rights Act is so important to me. In 1965, it wasn't actually until voter rights for Native American communities was solidified. And even then, disenfranchisement is taking place rampantly in especially rural Native American communities. So I see this work across multiple identities, being a woman, being Black, being Indigenous, as all stemming from the civil rights era. And I grew up with grandparents who were both civil rights activists, NAACP in Chicago and South Chicago. So this is all I've ever known in my life was this push and is this fight and is this mission for beloved community. I'm really glad that we've brought that into the space because really equitability in our communities is what we're all really looking for. And one of the things that I always bring up, especially when I'm given pushback, is the rhetoric of it's just not the right time. It's just not the right time for equity and equality and justice. I mean, but if we've been doing this work since early 1900s, 1800s, I mean, this revolution started as early as contact and forced displacement from Africa. Like, so we've been doing this for 400 years. Like, when is the right time to recognize the humanity of everybody in a very radical way? And so that's what really drives me and inspires me in this work. So that's really when I start to read that, it's especially the Civil Rights Act, I went back to refresh my memory on which one came first and the Voting Rights Act, et cetera. It represents for me a time in history when a new path was being forged so that I could do this work. And you know, so for personally, it's inspiration, but doing this work is me also honoring the ancestors who came before me in this work also. So thank you for that question.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll say, and this might be the teacher in me, or just I've been around the block a little bit longer than most of you. You know, don't sell yourself short, Ty. You are a strong woman. You are a community leader, and we need you, and we are grateful for you. Professor Sanders, did you have anything that you would like to add?
Well, first, I too want to take the time, which I didn't do before, which is to thank the City Club and everyone involved for the invitation today. I'm very honored to have been asked to participate in this conversation. And I'd like to say to Ty, I watched the video that was posted of you at the rally, and I think the courage in which you are able to confront blatant racism is exactly the type of voices that we need at our law school and in our legal community here in Idaho. So I would love to sit and talk to you and to convert you, which I believe I have already begun to do. So I am very happy to see that it's starting to take in. But in terms of turning my attention to the question, I think a lot about the Civil Rights Act because I often think more about my parents, and, to be honest, and my aunts and uncles and that generation of African Americans and other people of color and women. And especially, I think a lot about women of color when I think about the 1964 Act. If you think about it, if you look at the legislative record and debate, this was an economic legislation. This was a piece of economic legislation that very much was about equality and equity. We have to remember we had to pass a federal law because Black people couldn't stay at a hotel. Because Black, and the legislative record is about Black people sleeping on the side of the road. Let's think about this case is 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, and yet 10 years before the U.S. Supreme Court would enforce desegregation orders. So think about that entire generation of people who were sort of left with these you know, promises that were never kept, and who were kids, right, at these young impressionable ages. And so I reflect a lot about how, because that affected my family in that way, it affects me in a particular way, and it affects my professional environment in a particular way. It is because of the failure of these enforcements that I am the first African American to become a full professor at this university, despite the fact that it's 2020. Right. And this, to be fair to the university, this happened 2 years ago. But, you know, it took over 100 years for an African-American to become a full professor at the law school. To my knowledge, Mike, you were the first African-American hired and I was the second. And so the fact that this is a milestone to me is really, I say it because it's a fact, not because I celebrate it, because it's 2020. And the fact that that's a milestone in these days is interesting to me. The other thing that I think a lot about, too, is what the act doesn't cover. It doesn't cover our criminal justice system, which is where we needed the most civil rights in this country, especially in 1964, because the way we see criminal procedure today was very different. Mm-hmm. You didn't have all of your Bill of Rights back then. Mm-hmm. And so despite all that, however, I'll decline to speak about how I personally looked to this act to advocate my own rights. But of course, I stayed very mindful of that in the past year and a half. The Civil Rights Act has played a very personal and professional part of my life. And so it's interesting to reflect upon it that way as well. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Sanders. And you know, you brought something up, and I'll just throw this out here. You know, the timeline that we're talking about, we're not talking about an old timeline. And you brought up busing. I'm your moderator, and I was under a forced busing order as a child. And I remember construction workers throwing rocks at our bus. And I remember our bus driver, who was African-American, I was in second grade, and he just went crazy. And I didn't understand then why. And it wasn't until I was in law school, right, many, many years later, that I learned that I was under a busing order. And the reason he went he was so angry and actually went out there and challenged these construction workers by himself is because he had fought for these rights for us. Right. And he was the bus driver, but this was for us. And that's not so long ago. I mean, for the community, I'm here in the community and I was under a forced busing order.
Right. And I just want to add one thing, too, when it comes to the economic piece. This act comes sort of at the end of the implementation of all this New Deal legislation post-World War II, which we now know through empirical studies was administered in a pretty rich way. And so when I think about the economic element of this act, you know, I think that gets underscored a little too much.
And again, for example, the GI Bill, and it was administered in such a way to exclude African American veterans for many, many years. And it wasn't until this act that they finally started enforcing it for African American veterans. That's one example that's out there. So I had
before you go on to your next question, Mike, like you actually identify something. So especially in a lot of this work, people will say that we don't need affirmative action anymore. But I always identify the GI Bill as one of the like first examples of what affirmative action looked like specifically for white veterans that came back from the World Wars, distinctly excluding Black members of the military, indigenous members of the military. So if we're really going to like use the appropriate rhetoric in a historical lens like that, that would be it. GI Bill was affirmative action at one point.
Yeah. And I don't know if the audience can see, but I'm actually wearing my a pen from the United States Navy. I am a veteran myself and I benefited from the GI Bill. I used the GI Bill in law school, right? And so there was a change at some point, but that was in 2000 or the late 90s. So I had another question prepared for myself, but I think that we've thus far covered that question pretty well. So I'm going to actually move on to some audience questions. And I got a very good but simple question that I hear a lot in this sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion world. And it's just this basic one. It says, could a panelist or the panelists provide a definition of equality versus equity?
I guess I'll take that one because I said it. So
I was hoping you would.
Yeah. So equality in my mind is, let's say, I often use this with my colleagues in our office. So my boss may say, well, Sandra needs a chair. What we're going to do is order all these chairs, all these new chairs for all of the members of our department. Well, it's one brand of a chair and that's for everyone. Well, there may be someone that may be disabled or they may have a back problem or whatever the case may be. And they may say, it's nice to have a new chair, but that chair does not address my pre-existing need. And so of course I still need a chair, but I need a chair that will address my particular situation and need. And that's equity. So it's not asking necessarily for a better chair, it's asking for something that will better address whatever that need is. And so a lot of times when we're talking about it in a social justice, through a social justice lens, it's acknowledging that we all do not start from the same place. And so I often talk about, we have a culture of niceness where we believe that if we're just nice, that everything is equal and going to be fair. And that's why we are where we are today, right? And we're not as far as we need to go because we've allowed just being nice to trump really dealing with some of the systemic issues that have impacted our country. And so one of the things that I wanted to say is that we need policies that build on the Civil Rights Act that are transformational and liberatory. So we're not just looking for policies that just address kind of, it puts a Band-Aid over something. We want to have policies that liberate those who have been oppressed over particularly Black people for over 400 years since we've been on these shores.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Professor Sanders, did you have something you wanted to add?
And I'll add, a large part of equity is about inclusion, right? It's not enough to just open the door, but you need to provide the same opportunities. And so it's a lot about how do we look at how opportunities are created? And I think that's where this work gets really hard, because then you start to talk about disrupting a lot of historical behaviors and practices that many people are very comfortable with. Mm-hmm.
All right. And in that comfort, right, like 6 people of color and 7 women ran for the Democratic primary for the president back in March. I mean, over the course of last year. And we still, now moving into November, have 2 old white guys. Right. Like, so that if there's any that's a microcosm or macrocosm of like what that behavior looks like, that would be it. Right.
Well, thank you all for your comments. Professor Freeman, I do this work a lot, and I have all kinds of examples of for equity and inequality. Yours is my favorite. I love that one. It's so relatable, you know, and that's one of the goals here is to make things relatable. I really like that. So thank you so much. I want to move on to a policing question in a second, but first I need to say, first I would like to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Professor Sidney Freeman, Professor Shakira Sanders, and Ty Simpson. But before I move to that policing question, I got another great audience question that's very community focused, and it's initially at least directed at Dr. Freeman and then at Ty. So the first part of this question is, do teacher training programs adequately address inequality and racism in the classroom? And how can veteran teachers improve their competency here?
No. In simple, I think that you have to, so most of our teachers, you have to think about, if we're talking about the state of Idaho, I would make the strong assumption that most of our teachers have not had exposure to many faculty of color, whether it was in their elementary, secondary, or post-secondary settings, or going into college. And so having access to literature and resources around diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice is not necessarily a part of the curriculum, not interweaved throughout the curriculum. It's generally, if they are exposed to it, it's one class. And so I think there has to be much more done, and it's not just going to be having access to one half day training on diversity and inclusion. There needs to be training with regards to sensitivity around working with diverse students, and how do we expose our students who have, you know, most of their friends are white. How do you expose them to become culturally competent? So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I believe, for instance, in my College of Education, we only have one faculty member in our college, the College of Education, that focuses in, their job is to focus in on teacher preparation around diversity. Whereas when I'm talking about ethnic and racial diversity, when it comes to areas such as disability and other things, people are much more comfortable hiring people to come in and talk about that. But if we're going to have students that are culturally competent and reflective, and we're going to have teachers that are, I think more training is needed, and focus in that area is needed. I hope that answers the question.
I think it was very, very useful there. And for Ty, this is actually focused on you. And it is, what was your experience as a student in K through 12 like?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting interesting conversation. That might actually be a whole TED talk someday. My father, having grown up in rough circumstances as a young Black man in Chicago and South Chicago, made it a point to make sure we lived in predominantly white neighborhoods and went to predominantly white schools. And I think that in his mind, he was putting us in a position where we had access to quality education as we know it. I'm going to quote unquote that a little bit, right? And then that we had the right tools we needed to be successful in what we understand your Western colonial sense. But I did give a lot of pushback, right? Like I haven't said the pledge my whole life because my mother is fully Indigenous and lives entirely into that identity. And she says, that's not for us. So, and she was right. I never had to say it. When it came to getting Columbus Day and my classmates are like making these fake headdresses, my mother raised all of the hell. When it came to Black history, I had very, very strong Black grandparents who reminded me that our history is all of the time, every day, and it is not distinct from American history. We have these like identifiers of American history and Black history and East history, but all of it is American history. It is all interwoven, and the American education system doesn't treat it as such. I mean, one of the things that I did learn that the outputs of education, especially in Idaho, are so quantitative that these students don't have the opportunity to really engage in what, like in any of the human conversations about identity, right? And a lot of that conversation is, if we don't talk about race, race will go away, right? Like that doesn't, I'm gonna use kind of a harsh example, so I apologize for that. If we stop talking about cancer or any disease, it doesn't mean that it goes away. It just means that it's going to be really painful to navigate without having the knowledge or without having space to ask questions or explore further how we can be anti-racist, how we can be anti-oppression, how we can be anti-violent, right? Those are all conversations that are very difficult and very nuanced that we don't make room for teachers to have with their students, because the assumption is if we don't talk about it, it goes away. And I have a really difficult time with that. And I actually ended up not finishing high school in Idaho. I just quit high school more or less, and then went to college. One, so I could have a challenge. Two, that I felt a little bit more autonomy in the things that I was learning. And three, that I didn't feel so trapped in this curriculum. I didn't feel seen. I didn't feel heard. And after having spent a few years in Singapore at a Singapore international school, like it's a little bit more broad and much more vast. The settler colonialism is still similar because Singapore was a British colony rather than a more recent British colony than the United States. But it still gave me a very wide worldview on what education could be and what engaging in my education could look like. But Idaho was a trap. Education in Idaho is indeed a trap.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. So for this next question, it's about implicit bias. Just let me set the framework for our audience. Implicit bias is this concept that we all have some biases inside. And I often use myself as an example. I work a lot in the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion, yet I still have biases and I catch them. One of the things that changes when you work in this area isn't that the biases aren't there. It's whether it's TV and you're looking at, well, all the actors are white and that's what I want to be, or Barbie, you know, Barbie's all used to be white and it wasn't until recently. So that kind of put that image up high, whether that image is about race or whether that image is about a woman's body, right? It doesn't matter, right? We the world kind of builds these biases into us. And what I try to explain to people is you can't, we all have them. Right. And some of them go to extremes, right? Extreme racism and things like that. But it's more about catching them and seeing them. And the more you know, the more you learn and you see them and you can learn them yourselves. So that's what this question is about, implicit bias. And so for any of the panelists or all the panelists, however you'd like to go, and perhaps Shakira, you can start here with this one. In your opinion, is implicit bias the same as racial discrimination?
I don't know. because A, I don't think there's one type of implicit bias. I think it would depend on the severity of the implicit bias, and I think it would depend on how that implicit bias infects your employment, whether it's your employment opportunities, your pay, or all of these different things. So I guess part of my answer is I don't know. And maybe it's more of a maybe. I would say it can or cannot be. I guess I should be a really good law professor and just say it depends.
Excellent. Make everybody crazy. Yeah. Would either Dr. Freeman or Ty like to take a stab at that question?
Yes. I have a lot of robust and interesting conversations on Facebook around various issues of diversity and inclusion. And one of the things that I was talking about recently is about Stacey Abrams, the woman who is amongst other women who are being considered for the vice presidency, not for the vice presidency, but the vice president's presidential candidacy under Joe Biden. And so one of the things that I mentioned on yesterday is forms of an implicit bias around her as a Black woman. And so just to give you just a little taste of that, I had to pull up Facebook here. So I made sure I got my own words correct. So essentially I said, why I think people don't want Stacey Abrams to be vice president of the United States. She's too Black. She's not mixed race and or light skinned. She's not exotic. She's an American descendant of slaves. Her lineage is Mississippi and Georgia, not Caribbean, South American, or her parents are not recent immigrants to the United States from America. She's not conventionally attractive. I said in parentheses, European style. Thin, light colored eyes, and long permed hair. She has a gap and wears twist. She's too young, she's too ambitious, and she's not married. So when we're talking about implicit bias is these things that have nothing, these are things that have nothing to do with her policies, her policy positions. They have nothing to do with her necessarily with her credentials. They're all about these things that we see externally are signals, signals to us that we can be comfortable with her. So for instance, she has dreads, she has twist. So we are still having problems right now in various schools and various professions around can women or individuals, period, have colored hair or different colored hair rather than just their natural color hair, or have twist or these other things. And because a person may have a certain amount of jewelry on, whether it's in their ears or other piercings, we say, if I'm on the other side of the table, decision-making table, I could, if I don't like a person's nose ring, I could say, well, I don't know if that person is really someone that we want in our office, even though they are qualified, highly qualified, all those good things. But there's something about that person because they're dressed or their background is different that I'm not as comfortable with. So that's why there's this, and I know Professor Sanders can probably speak to this, there's this pushback on the notion of fit now. Before we would say we want to hire the best person that will fit our culture, where a lot of times that allowed for a lot of discrimination to go on because this person was not necessarily a fit for us. And so lastly, I'll say this. I'm so glad that we're having these kind of frank conversations because it allows us to break what I'm calling the unspoken contract
that we have with white America, which does not allow us to say, we know that this happens, right? We know that this is, Black people know this is happening, right? So let's just keep it real or be open about it. We, someone put it this way, that in the case of Stacey Abrams, she is not white adjacent. What I mean by that is she doesn't, because she presents herself as a Black woman, right? And all of its fullness and richness, a lot of times, so I often say this about myself, I am blessed that I'm now in a generation where I don't have to code switch the way in which generations in the past have had to do. So what I mean by code switch is that many times African Americans have had to present themselves in such a way that it makes them comfortable around white company to get ahead. And now I've been blessed to have dreads down my back. You guys can't, everyone can't see me, those that are going to be listening on the radio, but I have dreads down my back and I'm not speaking, I don't feel the need to have to speak in a particular way to just make white people feel comfortable. So those are things that are that I believe are important when thinking
and
about
it. And if I could interject, sorry, Ty, and Mike, to emphasize what Dr. Freeman said, which is we cannot underemphasize the fact that because a woman like Stacey Abrams is a woman, her looks and her attractiveness in any position that she seeks in this world are going to be the number one thing that people notice and what will attract other people to you if you're a woman. That's one of those silent things that we women don't always talk about, but we know it, right? Yeah. Looks matter. And it matters, number one, if you're a woman. And regardless, even if you're in like a ugly woman competition, you know, your looks are still the number one thing there. So there's that. And two, I think when it comes to what that means is that because African-American women are perceived to be the lowest on the American totem pole and the Western, and I would say more American totem pole, because I do think when it comes to beauty standards, the world does distinguish between African nationals now and African-American. And still for African-American women, the best way to be seen as beautiful is if you're mixed race. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be mixed with white, right? It could be mixed Asian, it could be mixed indigenous, but it's gotta be mixed with something. And usually if you're sort of present as more authentically dark skinned, slave descendant, chubbier, right? Then you're sort of falling out of line with the beauty standard. Of course, beauty standards do change depending on your skin color, right? Maybe if she were a lighter skin African-American woman, her figure would count less in her candidacy and how we perceive her. So there are all these sort of unconscious and conscious standards that we as women have to deal with. And once you are African-American, there's like that extra layer, because of course, a lot of Obama's appeal was that he was the cool Black guy, right? Now you may not have thought he was hood, but he still came off as a very cool Black guy. And a lot of people were attracted to that.
Yeah.
I think still for African-American women, there's no like cool Black girl stereotype for people into that helps you. The number one stereotype is just being a very European presenting, light skinned, straight haired African American.
If I can just add on, when you said Obama, it just made me think of just that narrative that his mother was from Canada, for instance. That's the, when I talk about white adjacency, thing that makes people say, oh, I have a parent from the Midwest, and those kinds of things send those signals. When you don't have those things, is the playing field necessarily level for opportunity.
No doubt it made a huge difference that his mother was white, right? And I remember the 08 campaign, and you saw a lot of that white family, but you didn't necessarily see as much as the African-American side. Now, the African side, I should say. Now, a lot of that was because his father was foreign. But you certainly didn't really, you know, like it was very much a subtle part of the campaign. But I think the half whiteness definitely.
And Ty, I actually have a question directly for you. If we could, I could move us along. But first, again, I'm going to do my radio blurb. I would like to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Sydney Freeman, Shakira Sanders, and Ty Simpson. And I'm actually going to answer one question here real quickly that came up. So an important piece of equity and inclusion is also accountability. And it's holding yourself accountable if you make a mistake or explaining that, but still accepting that accountability. So here's a question that came across. Interesting to me that Mike Satz calls the women by their first names and yet addresses Dr. Freeman. Is this implicit bias? And so it's actually complicated here with this crowd. So Sydney Freeman has a PhD, and I come from academic world. So we call people with PhDs doctor. I have a Juris Doctor, and Professor Sanders has a Juris Doctor. And so we don't call ourselves doctors. So I try to call Professor Sanders. And because I have a very academically credentialed panel, I'm calling Ty, although I can call her Ms. Simpson as well. But that's why. And I actually put a lot of thought into this beforehand. However, that does not mean that I did not make a mistake, right? That does not mean I know that I said Shakira, you know, she came first and then me. I know I said that. And to answer your question for the audience member, yes, that is implicit bias, because the appropriate way to respond here beyond familiarity and knowledge of these people is to always address Professor Sanders as Professor Sanders, to always address Ty Simpson as Ms. Simpson, and to always address Sydney Freeman as Dr. Freeman, if we're going to use formalities. So, gotcha. You got me. And that's good. And I accept that. And I own that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I did the same thing. I definitely called Dr. Freeman. I think some of my implicit bias is education, academic bias. The fact that he's got that PhD always makes him Dr. Freeman to me.
Yeah.
Whereas Mike, I think with you and I think it's because we were colleagues and we're used to it.
Sure. Absolutely. But I think that's a very fair question, and we're in a public forum, and the people who are listening don't know our background. And so I will own that. And I will say, yes, that's exactly what it is. I should have been more cautious. So thank you to the listener who did that.
Can I interject really quick?
We got to get to time.
Okay. And just quickly is that I've written an article called Put Some Respect On My Name, which actually addresses this very issue in professional settings. How do we navigate, particularly with women and people of color, and ensuring that we address them with the appropriate title? Is actually one of the first articles that specifically address this in the academic and professional forum in a academic journal. So I can share that with you guys.
And you know, in our community, I hear this a lot with, for example, the president of Boise State University. I hear a lot of men address her as Marlene. And to me, she's President Trump or Dr. Trump. But that goes around and around. And I think that it's very accurate that we should be treating people equally with equal respect. So again, thank you to that listener for bringing that up. You heard it spark even more conversation about it. So Ms. Simpson, I will start this question with you. you're laughing at me. What the audience doesn't know is Ms. Simpson and I first met when she was a teenager up in Moscow many years ago. Not that many years ago, right?
Right. So it's been a long time since I've been a teenager.
It's been a while, though. Yes, yeah, right. So Ms. Simpson, this question came across, and this is a question that we hear in this dialogue a lot. And this is this question. I hear white Idahoans say there is no racism in Idaho. And so the questioner is, what do I say to them, and how can I advance the struggle for equity?
Oh, again, that's such a heavy question. heavy question. Yes, there's a lot of racism that exists in Idaho, right? But this even comes down to like circling back to the implicit bias question. So it really is a lack of exposure and then also willful ignorance, like this unwillingness to have these questions and ask hard questions of their non-white neighbors, where they remain willfully ignorant of the fact that racism is deep, deep in this state. We're talking like some of the white supremacists are elected to legislatures. Some of the supremacists are cops. Like it is deep, deep in this state. And those are really hard, ugly conversations that folks don't want to have. Like we in Idaho especially perpetuate this idea that racism is an individual moral failing rather than very deeply embedded in like nefarious systems. And we feel it very acutely when we are Black or are Indigenous or are Latinx. And that's something that we really need to address in a very nuanced way. However, when you ask Black and Brown and Indigenous bodies to have those conversations, you're also putting those people at risk physically, professionally, academically, to be sharing that knowledge. They may not be in the safe space where they can have those honest conversations. And so that's also something like take responsibility for learning that knowledge. Like you could Google like racism, anti-oppression, and there will be a series of resources for folks to really understand what implicit bias is, what oppression looks like in the workplace, intersectionality, and why that's also important in these conversations. And really avoid confirmation bias. Like that works hand in hand with implicit bias, right? In Idaho, they'll hear one Black person say a thing and then cling to that for the rest of their lives as if all Black people are this monolith, as if all Native Americans are a monolith. Some kind of high level examples of how deeply embedded racism in it, like it shouldn't have been the fight that it was to remove some of these Native American mascots, right? It shouldn't have been the ugly, grueling fight we just had over affirmative action in our legislature. It shouldn't have been the fight that it was to recognize missing and murdered Indigenous people in this state. Like those are all very high level things, but indicative of deeply embedded systems here. I did want to circle back to the implicit bias in naming. Like I introduce myself generally in my Indigenous language when I get started, and like to decolonize this idea of academic and professionalism, those are all indicators of white supremacy. Also, what is professional in the United States is based on whiteness. What is academic in the United States is based on whiteness. So I like when I go home, I don't ever lead in community with like, these are my accolades and these are my titles, because my family and my aunties and my cousins are still going to roast me with nicknames anyway, right? And that's what we do to keep each other humble. That's what we do as a reminder that in community or in any setting, we are never too big for who and where we came from. And I'm a radical futurist, right? Like I believe in decolonizing some of these systems. So Mike, I'll probably call you Mike for forever. Like Shakira, I will probably call Shakira for forever. Sydney, unless you tell me you want to be called doctor, I will probably call you Sydney, like just to decolonize this idea that we are respectable, worthy human beings without any of these titles assumed in white institutions. So that's kind of my little rant on that.
That is, it's so
except for in the classroom.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Professor Sanders in the classroom.
Professor Sanders, I'm sorry,
Mike, but I do want to say what you said, Ty, there. What I picked up on a lot is how ignorance fuels so much of white supremacy, discrimination, bias, and harassment. And I may be getting myself in some good trouble here, but in honor of the late John Lewis, one of the things that I think about in terms of a possible return to live teaching is the fact that I work in a law school building that has racist murals painted all over it. And the most racist parts are covered. And as an institution, we've been sort of skipping along as if that's okay. But I've recently revealed to my colleagues that I don't use our stairwell, right? Because I don't want to see it. And now I have a new office where I think I can avoid those murals all together. And I know year after year, there are students who don't like that imagery, feel as if they have to suck it up. But because so many people are ignorant as to what makes it racist, right? It's seen as kind of like, it's not as bad. And then you can get the, oh, we don't have budget to do anything, yada, yada, yada. And yet, underlying all that is the expectation that I and others who feel the same way have to put up, right? Have to tolerate this type of racist imagery on a daily basis. And it's what's expected of us that kind of sort of causes us, right? That's part of the conversation is, when do we sort of say, hey, maybe you don't have to tolerate that?
And you know, you had to hit that sore point right there. What the audience does not know is I was associate dean and interim dean of the College of Law at a time when we were building out that law school building. And I still, to this day, I was the interim dean and I tried to have those removed and I could not. I could not get those removed. And that is the single greatest professional failing that I have had in my entire career, is not getting those removed. And every time I walk past them, and what the audience needs to know is it's a lynching of a Native American. It's not historical. It's just a lynching. It's depicting the story of the capture and then the lynching. It's not historical. We've proven that. But even I was unable to get them removed. And I walk on those staircases when I go in, and I feel shame when I walk by the cover, those covered murals, because I couldn't do anything about it. And I tried, you know, many of us did try. Maybe the time is right now, right?
The whole tableau is troubling. Yeah, I'll just say that. The whole tableau.
Right. So now, of course, Ty, after that, I don't know what to do as far as addressing people. But you are right? I'm thinking of our audience, and I'm thinking I want our audience to have the right respect for the members of this panel. To the audience, this is my first experience with City Club with an all panel of people who are African-American descendants. Right? I have not seen this, and to my knowledge, this is the first time. And so it was very important to me that you feel the respect that these three panelists have earned. And so that's why I was trying to be so careful about Dr. Freeman and Professor Sanders and Ms. Simpson. But Ty, Ms. Simpson, made an excellent point. It is the majority's language. It's the majority that have set the standard for how we address one another. And it's just something that we should all think about from time to time.
I'm sorry, Dr. Freeman. So I think that might be one of the biggest takeaways for today, though, right? Like, we are all Black, so we have a shared experience, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have a shared vision. And our work, however we approach our professions or social justice work, isn't always going to look the same to everybody. It's all very nuanced. And there is as much diversity and nuance and creativity and expression within a Black community as there are amongst humans in general, right? So I really, I don't want us to be siphoned into these singular depictions or iterations of what Blackness is in Idaho, because we also have a really bad habit of that in our community.
Yeah, great, thank you. Dr. Freeman?
She addressed it out. I know you still have some other questions, so we can keep it moving.
All right. So we'll move along. I don't want to get away from what's really spurring this conversation right now. And this may be kind of our last part of this. But I mean, we've seen these Black Lives Matter protests across the country. And I've got to tell you, I'm in my 50s, and the last 3 or 4 years has been very difficult for me, because I feel like I'm a target again. And we can look, we all have different experiences. I'm mixed race, much, much lighter than the rest of you. I was first on campus with dreadlocks before Mother Nature took over, but I didn't have the same experience. I guarantee you I was much more approachable to a lot of people than, say, Dr. Freeman is, because of my skin color, and I was raised in a white family in the way I talk. But it's been a very difficult time period for me, and I think it's been a very difficult time period for everyone of color, really, right now, particularly Black people. And this question gets around this Black Lives Matter issue But it basically says, how does whataboutism or all lives matter hold back the promise of the Civil Rights Act? Right? And so often we'll say Black Lives Matter. So I think it's okay to actually come out and have someone talk about why are we saying Black Lives Matter? And how does that juxtapose against this concept of all lives matter? Or what about these people? Or what about that person?
I'll go ahead and get started with that. And I'm also going to like really rein in my rage because I always have like a constant like a visceral response when I hear that. So I think that folks' initial reaction to hearing Black Lives Matter is only Black Lives Matter versus Black Lives Also Matter, right? So there's a very, very important distinction in there that people who are unfamiliar with the movement and who are unfamiliar with equity work that don't hear Black Lives Matter also, when so much sociological data, political science data, economic data tells us that we don't and haven't since the inception of the United States. And the people who say all lives matter also believe, you know, the people who said all men are created equal in the Constitution are the, like, that's like, there's a very distinct cognitive dissonance in that, that we need to address. And until statistically we see that folks of color and communities of color are treated with equity and justice across the board, we will continue to say Black Lives Matter. We will continue to say her name, because the onslaught or the seriousness of Black Lives Matter as it relates to trans and Black women is out of control. Like, so that, I mean, again, that's a whole TED talk for a different day, but I want to call that into the space that when we say Black Lives Matter, that adversely affects the trans community and Black within Black communities as well. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the idea of relegating and dehumanizing the movement also, right? Like if we're made to seem as unreasonable in our social justice work by saying, well, why not all lives? Think about burning houses, right? Like if my house is burning down, nobody else's house is burning down, but then the fire truck shows up and says, well, all houses matter, right? Like that doesn't make any sense. Like help the people whose house is burning down in this moment and burning down in a very ferocious and violent way. Like that's the work, you know, and that's the message that we're trying to convey.
Very, very well said. Thank you so much. Either Professor Sanders or Dr. Freeman. I see Mo. There you go.
Sorry for that. I don't know what I was getting wrong there. You know, I want to echo everything that Ms. Simpson said, which, you know, that's, if you were in class, we would be using Ms. Simpson. I want to say for me, in some ways, when I think about the phrase Black Lives Matter, I actually think of it literally and figuratively. Like for me, it means both, right? That there is something special about the way Black, negatively special about the way Black people have been treated. It's just fact. We don't need to debate it. And so we do need to really think about the way we treat Black people in terms of our baseline, right? Our bottom line, right? The floor as opposed to the ceiling. And in the way I think about it, Black lives have always been more the floor in this country than the ceiling. But there's also this idea that so much of our civil rights law, our constitutional law on equal protection, substantive due process evolved out of the legal fight for African Americans, right? And so African American story is the story of America. It is what sells that promise of America. Unfortunately, Indigenous lives don't sell as well, because that's part of the story too. But for me, when I think about Black lives, it includes Indigenous lives, because without treatment of Indigenous people, we would not have had the treatment of African slaves in this country. So for me, when we say Black Lives Matter, is an acknowledgement of the generational failure to end and remedy systematic discrimination in this country.
Right.
So, thank you. So when I hear your question, I think about the focus on who gets to name and define phrases and issues related to those who are marginalized and underrepresented. And I feel like a lot of times it's a form of what one of my colleagues calls a theory of white arrogance, that white people can
can often believe that they have the right to define everything. And that's why we often have this issue with the N-word, who can use the N-word. I said to some of our leaders on campus that white people don't have the moral authority to define issues around definitions around race and inclusion. They just don't have the moral authority to do that, given the way in which they've operated and set up a complex system that marginalizes and has pillaged so many that are not white. And so to build on both what Ms. Simpson and Professor Sanders said, I draw on the work of Dr. James Cone, who is what we call the father of Black liberation theology. And a lot of times people kind of got mixed up when he would define or talk about Black liberation theology. He was not only talking about just Black as in skin color, he was defining it as those who are the least and those who were left out. So it does tie to what Ms. Simpson was saying, in that it does include indigenous, and it does include others who are those who have been displaced, hurt, misused. All of those things are important. And as I conclude with this statement, one of the things that really pushed me to think as it related to kind of the fight for Black lives is when I heard one Black conservative pundit say on MSNBC, are we going to be comfortable as a nation that Black people will be a perpetual underclass? Let that sink in. Because I've often said in other spaces that Black people are only 13% of the population in this country. That means if the majority of the country came together and said, we have this particular small population, subpopulation within our larger population that has been mistreated, misused. We want to create policies and practices that addresses that those people. They can do it, and we've seen them do it, particularly in the education space and other spaces as it relates to our Asian brothers and sisters, right? Providing opportunities and things like that. So it can happen, right? We just have to have the will to do it. And so there is a question around this whole notion of just being, Yahweh Brown talks about a polite white supremacy where white people are able to name or feel like they can still name and influence everything, but not really engage with marginalized communities around how we can uplift so that we all can engage in ensuring that everyone is treated equitably.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. And with that, I will just make a comment that as a teacher, so much of what we do is we are driving with our conversation to the tip of the spear. At the end is the tip of the spear. I think all three of your answers just now was that tip of the spear. And so I think that this is a great place to conclude this program. Before I conclude, first, I would like to thank City Club President Karen Sander, who it was really her vision here. City Club is the first of a series on race, racism, discrimination, which will include sex discrimination, which will include homophobia. Right, we're going to move forward, and we're going to take this as a community member and bring this conversation to the community. But it was our president, Karen Sander, who really had the vision to say, let's do this and put a group together. So thank you so much for doing this. I'd like to thank our panelists for agreeing to participate in this. We're very, very grateful for that. And so for everyone, please join me in thanking Professor Dr. Freeman, Professor Sanders, and Ms. Simpson for participating in today's discussion. Thank you all so much, and we really very much appreciate it. And I hope, audience, that this was as stimulating a conversation for you as it was for us here. Thank you.